thinking about it, it's just really weird to be inside of it and thinking about it. But going back, I mean, you know, when we were 5 years into the band or 4 years, we played Red Rocks or backed Lee Scratch Perry or made a record in Jamaica. We've always kind of put the cart before the horse with this band, just because we're one of the more ambitious groups of people that you know, we've met touring. And the goal has always just been to, like, be true to ourselves and play the kind of music we want to play.
Hey everyone, it's Joel Freemark, and welcome to the Earfuel podcast. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at @GetEarfuel and at The Daily Guru. And hey, the podcast is over on iTunes under Earfuel and at SoundCloud.com/GetEarfuel. All the shameless plugging is now out of the way. What you heard at the top was a clip from the interview I did with Lionize the other week. We talked digital music, stupid rock critics, the insane release schedule they're going to do in 2016. It's outrageous. We will get to that momentarily right after I give you a quick album review of a record you definitely need to check out. Today, I want to talk to you about the new album from the band Heaters, and it's called Holy Water Pool. Now, Heaters, if you don't know them, you really need to. They're a trio from Michigan, and honestly, it's actually a bit tough to describe them. There are these strong elements of metal and jam band and jazz and prog rock and surf rock and psychobilly. There's so many sounds going on here, but somehow they managed to take all of those different sounds and influences and make it sound really, really good. Seriously, they've got this kind of sludgy, heavy on the reverb, almost trance metal thing going on. Can we make trance metal a thing? We're making trance metal a thing. If you're into bands like, I don't know, Dead Meadow, Sleep, of course, even the Beach Boys, I couldn't get the Beach Boys out of my head while I was listening to this. There is plenty to dig here. Now, to be honest, they really do a good job here of taking the kind of psychedelic, the neo-psych bass, and they push it into so many different styles and approaches. Now, granted, it's very loud. We're talking Dinosaur Jr. in-your-face awesomeness. I love that they have volume all across the album. There's also great fuzz running across the whole album, and it's really, for me, the way that the guitars pierce through this smoky haze that makes this record so enjoyable. You really got to hear it. It's so, so cool. You've got everything from a retro undertone on songs like Master Splinter. Yes, Master Splinter is the name of the song. And Bad Beat. There's a nod to Pink Floyd on the opening. And then there's outright surf rock on a number of songs like Hawaiian Holiday. And it's really, really cool. They just are able to kind of have the same core idea, but do it in so many different ways. On the song Gumdrop, they almost go straight up dream pop. It's really neat, and you can really sink into that track. It's one of my favorites. It has this warm, encompassing feel to it. One of the big keys here is that while the band is getting incorrectly pigeonholed into the psych rock world, when they settle into a groove, they don't feel the need to, like, stay there for 10 or 15 minutes like so many bands try to do. They really beat the dead horse and all that. These guys do not take that approach. They understand, they hit the groove, they really push it around a bunch, and then they get out. It's a lot more accessible than you might think when someone says psych rock and kind of jammy on it. You definitely need to check these songs. What I mean is, they clearly understand the lifespan of a song. They're not going to sit on a single moment or a single note or in a groove just for the sake of making it a longer song. All in all, Holy Water Pool is a solid listen from beginning to end. If you're into huge musical atmospheres and outstanding musicianship and just something new, if you're into that, and I really hope you are. So also, if they're coming near your town on tour, you need to go see them. Trust me, you're really going to enjoy it. So there's the new album you need to check out. And the other week, I had a chance to hang out with the guys from Lionize before they took the stage here in New York City. I've hung out with them once or twice before. They're awesome guys, and we actually did this podcast in their dressing room. So when you hear random saxophones, some screaming, and just randomness, it happens backstage. Now, Lionize are about to release a handful of singles, EPs, and a full album all over the next 6 months. Something like 30-plus songs they're going to put out in that time period. It's a ridiculous amount of output. And if you're not already into them, you really need to be. They're one of my favorite bands out there right now. Head over to lionizemusic.com and get yourself learned. And now, a brief conversation with Lionize.
Well, we just wanted you to talk before.
That was the thing. You and the rest of the world.
What is this? This is like early in the tour, right? Like just started.
Day four.
Uh-huh. And you guys haven't killed each other yet?
No.
Yeah, that's usually like day 16.
Uh-huh.
Something like that.
You guys, though, you know, we'll get to just how ambitious a project you guys are on the verge of right now. You guys tour unrelentingly. how do you guys find time to actually get into the studio to record the massive amount of music you've recorded?
We took almost, I wouldn't say a full year, but we took about a solid 6 months to start the recording project and get our studio up and running. That was probably the longest time we've ever taken off of a proper touring. Mm-hmm. And it'll probably, for the next foreseeable future, also be the longest period of time without that much touring. Because now that it's set up, in between tours, we can just show up and record.
And just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And where did you guys set up? Where is this? Where is the Lion Eyes Cave?
It's in my basement.
Oh, okay. Okay.
As all good proper studios are.
I mean, if it's not in a basement, how would you know you were in a studio?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, had you guys been planning on this for a while, you know, kind of doing your own place to sit where you guys could kind of go where you wanted recording-wise?
We've been talking about it. I don't think we finished the last record and thought, wow, the next time we'll just do it ourselves.
Uh-huh.
It sort of was something that evolved from, you know, just the whole situation that we're in. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a lot better for us to move forward knowing that we can make all our records on our own and not, you know, have to be loaned money or spend a bunch of money.
Sure.
Or save a bunch of money.
Sure.
You know, just be able to get up and do it and get out of the cycle of having to wait until we have a pile of 10 songs and go into the studio and record them all and however, you know, not enough time,
uh-huh.
You know, it is. Just kind of just do it.
So once you guys kind of settled in there and you started recording, did you kind of have a point where you said, okay, we have to stop recording here? Because by my best guess, you've got, what, about 30-some-odd songs that you're going to release in the next 6 months here, something around there?
Yeah.
Some ridiculous number like that?
They're not all completely finished, but at the end of the day, there will be 30 or 40 pieces that have been touched on, at least to try to, you know, make into something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you've got to be able to, you know, pick a couple and set an endpoint, pick a few and be like, we're going to work on these, and, you know, you're so close to them that you've got to find a point where you just, the four of us, decide we're happy with what that is.
Uh-huh.
And then you do the next one, you know.
Do you want to explain exactly what you guys are doing with, you know, with the singles and the EPs and then the full length?
To not make it incredibly convoluted.
There we go.
We are going to put out, starting 2 days ago,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be 3 singles that are going to be released between now and December 20th.
Okay.
And that will lead into a 6-song EP, which is the first EP that we're going to have released completely independently and from start to finish. Every piece of work that went into it is the band is doing it, from mixing to engineering to the whole nine. That EP is going to start a chain of events, if you will, of EPs that will range between 3 or 4 new EPs coming out before next spring.
Mm-hmm.
And ballpark around the summertime, we're going to release a full-length album that correlates everything that we've done up until then. And then the cycle kind of will start over. So the real broad plan is to be continuously releasing music, whether it's something we want to do at the drop of a hat,
mm-hmm.
or this plan is basically like a long-term continual release project.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's no real goal for ending it. It's just
when it's done, if ever.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to do some dub versions of some things and
uh-huh.
put out, you know, alternate takes of different stuff and mess with the mix a little bit at some point.
How has that impacted your writing process and the creative process? Since you're no longer constrained to, you know, here you have a record due, or, you know, it has to flow like this, you know, it has to be something sellable, so to speak.
I think what's always been easy for us is to actually write the songs and to put, you know, put the music together and get into a room and arrange and all that stuff. Like, that is the easy part. We could do that, you know, all day long. We did 2 records in 2011 because we had the resources to do it,
uh-huh.
you know? It's like, for us, it's always the hurdle has always been having the resources to go into the studio and put it on tape. So it's just fitting for a band that writes as prolifically as we do that we could just make the recordings ourselves and just put them out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no use waiting. We need to wait a year to put out 10 songs. We can put out 4 when they're ready and they go together, or maybe 3 because one didn't go with that 3 and we'll put it with the next group or whatever.
Yeah. How did you guys decide kind of what songs were going to be on the EPs and, you know, and that? Was it kind of recording time? Did you guys? Is there kind of a cohesive concept to each part?
It's sort of all coming together that the tunes that we'll put on the EPs will fit together.
Uh-huh.
What exactly that means or what it'll be isn't exactly determined.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a whole thing in process. We're just confident that we can write prolifically enough to make it happen. You know,
sure.
I mean, not that we don't have like almost 30 songs in the bag, like you said, but they're certainly not all tracked and recorded and
sure.
arranged, and you know, they're all in different stages of development.
Okay.
Yeah.
The last record, Jetpack Soundtrack, which is one that I openly love a lot. It was really a lot more straightforward of a rock record. That was a hard rock record compared to the one before it that, you know, the reggae influences were a lot more prominent. The songs I've heard, the new songs that I've heard so far, they're kind of a balance of both, but it seems that the reggae sounds are pushing a little bit more into the songs than on Jetpack Soundtrack. Was that conscious or it just sort of happened?
I think that just sort of, like Chris was saying, we just write so much stuff. It's kind of a process where we don't know what anything's really going to end up being, you know, and we don't know what the songs evolve as the more you play them and the more you develop, you know, the melodies and the lyrics and everything. I don't think we set out and be like, let's play more reggae stuff. It just, it's kind of a pendulum that's swinging, you know, and that's always been a huge part of our influences and what we do. And it just, I think that's just what came out when we got in a room and started mm-hmm. playing. You know? Mm-hmm.
Just kind of followed the muse.
Yeah.
So you guys have been playing for a decade now, thereabouts. One might say you guys are just starting to hit your stride now with just this amount of output. Do you guys feel that? You know, do you feel that you've kind of entered a new era as a band?
It's a big question.
I like big questions.
I think that the band is hitting a stride in the sense that people who are seeing us for the first time and don't know that we have a history, we're 10 years into playing with each other. So maybe we have a leg up on a band that has been playing together for 3 years.
We're definitely a better live band than we've ever been.
Thinking about it, it's just really weird to be inside of it and thinking about it. But going back, I mean, you know, when we were 5 years into the band or 4 years, we played Red Rocks or backed Lee Scratch Perry or made a record in Jamaica. We've always kind of put the cart before the horse.
Uh-huh.
With this band, just because we're one of the more ambitious groups of people that you know we've met touring, and the goal has always just been to like be true to ourselves and play the kind of music we want to play. So maybe it's taken a people a lot longer to catch on,
mm-hmm.
but we're starting to see the results of that. Just in the UK, is people know who we are there now, and
sure.
in South America, we're getting serious radio play. So I think it's always been our kind of thing where it's like, or any band you like seeing, you know, I think the era, you know, of, for instance, I mean, Hendrix was playing, you know, most people think, oh, Hendrix went to England for 1 year and then it took off. That's so factually yeah, untrue.
Right, right.
He had been playing for years and years and years on the Chitlin circuit, backing Little Richard,
yeah.
doing blues bars. I mean, you name it, he was doing it, and he was doing it for so long. And then, you know, you take that time to hone your craft and get mm-hmm. good at it. And then people all of a sudden they discover you and you're new to them, and that's great. But you have a back catalog of experience to draw from. So yeah. I to me, it seems like there's no better way to do it, really.
The big question I always want to ask is, are you guys having fun with what you're doing now? Because I know some albums, they're a struggle to record, you know, you kind of have to fight it a bit. Was this just kind of, you guys said, okay, we're going to record until this point, and, you know, what stopped the recording process? You know, was it becoming too much of a job?
In terms of going to a studio and recording?
No. With what you guys are doing now in the basement.
This recording process has not stopped.
Uh-huh.
It is ongoing.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, we're having fun because we just keep doing it.
You guys are just kind of yeah. taking a break to play some live yeah. shows, air yourselves right. out.
I mean, not even. Like, we'll be on headphones later working on, uh-huh. you know, editing stuff that needs to be edited or mixing stuff that needs to be mixed. It's just like an ongoing process. And, yeah, it's fun because making music is the most fun part, you know? Like, sitting in a van is not fun, like, in a vacuum.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
But writing music is, you know, it's the thing that pulls you in the first place.
And obviously you guys can do a lot of this stuff, like you said, just get in the van and do your editing because of where we are digitally and technologically. Obviously there's a love-hate relationship with, you know, like digital recording and stuff like that, because a lot of people, myself included, feel you lose something in that. Do you guys feel that the digital space is to your advantage as musicians and as kind of music as a whole, or do you see it causing problems?
In short, absolutely. It's integral to be a part of using digital software and recording with a computer. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely how everything works now and how it's going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I refuse to make this band a relic in the sense that, you know, we have to be... I don't think we consider ourselves a retro-style band.
Uh-huh.
And yet it's an easy label to give us if you assume that we record all of our stuff to tape and play out of old amps and play with Leslie speakers and all that kind of shit, you know? So, no, I think it's as artists, it's super important to not block that out and to say, rather than, you know, it doesn't sound as good as the old stuff, well, let's figure out how to make it sound great in its own way or as good as the old stuff.
I just feel like it's a tool like anything else, and there's a really advantageous, cool way to use it, and you can use it in ways that I don't think we would see as cool, but it's all about making the most of what's there.
Yeah, it's not always what the tool is, but rather who's using it, I think. So, you know, there's a lot of tools out there that can be used for good or bad purposes, and I think if you use it, I don't know, in a tasteful way, there are many pros I see that outweigh the cons by a long shot.
With you know, that obviously artists seem to get a pretty big shaft financially from it. Things like Spotify and streaming music is one of the biggest fights for bands like you guys right now. Where do you guys come out on that?
One thing, streaming is inevitable. You know, it's just going to happen whether once you put it out there, even if it's going to happen. So I think you have to operate from that as the first thing. Like, it's going to be streamed and people are going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you just have to work... find the way to work within the system that benefits your band the most, you know.
And for us, I see it as being the getting the music out there as is very important, because we see ourselves as one of our strengths is the live show.
Sure, absolutely.
So if we can get the music out there to more people and that gets more people out to the gigs, we're way happier if that happens.
And that's sort of the it's a cause and effect thing. I mean, that's exactly why we've had to learn how to use a computer to record our music ourselves. Because, you know, if you can't make $100,000 on a record, you can't spend $70,000 on it.
Sure, right.
You know, if you're going to make $5,000 on a record and you spend $500, well, that's a win, you know. Or if you just simply don't, you know, lose a bunch of money or can't go to the studio to record your music. Mm-hmm. As a songwriter, it's like super powerful.
Yeah.
To get your stuff out and let people listen to it. You know,
and also sustainability. If we can, this is all just to help us keep this vehicle going, you know, and we're going to do it as long as we can. So if that's the case, if your costs are way lower and you don't need as much in return, but you're still able to get your music out there and it helps you keep going, then then I'm all for it.
So I'm going to drop this on you. It's never going to go away. You guys are a rock style band. You like the rock and roll. You like to play it loud. And how do you guys respond to the masses that feel, you know, rock is dead, current music sucks, this, that, and the other thing?
I think they're right and they're wrong at the same time. I think it's the Schrodinger's cat of opinions on music. I think, first off, rock and roll will never die. Let's just, you know, let's quote Neil Young for a minute. It's impossible to kill something, I think, that gets people so excited. And I can name bands right now, and you can go as commercial as the Foo Fighters, being the biggest band in the world.
Absolutely.
AC/DC just had the number one highest grossing ticket sale concert of the year. Okay, they beat out Selena Gomez, Taylor Swift. They beat them out. AC/DC been doing it since the late 60s. So you have that. You have the Arctic Monkeys. You have Royal Blood. You have Clutch, of course. I mean, we can't they're as big as they've ever been right now.
Yeah.
How fast did that Led Zeppelin concert at O2 Arena sell out?
Like, what, like within 7 minutes or something?
They sold out three nights at
O2, it was ridiculous.
Like, for Celebration Day?
Yeah,
and the DVD was on the top of the chart. I mean, anyway, so I think that kind of correlates back to the other thing, which is really interesting, that we were talking about before. The same people who tell you that the music industry sucks or that current music sucks.
Yeah.
A, those are the same people that are not seeking out new music. There is a lot of shit out there, I agree. But that's because, you know, we're talking about computers. It's made it easier for anyone to get music out there.
Yeah.
So now you have to sift a little bit harder, but there's absolutely great bands out there making rock music, without a doubt. And we've toured with a lot of them.
Yeah.
So we've seen it firsthand. Kamchatka, Orange Goblin. I mean, I could go down the list forever. The Sword, Red Fang. I mean, you just...
Sure.
And then I think the same people who are telling you that the industry sucks and it's shit and there's nothing good are the same people who have been banking and raping bands for the last 20 years since the 80s. They're the ones who have figured out how to fuck the artist from the get-go. And now that the people have figured out how to directly connect with the artist, they're going, the music industry is in shambles and everything's fucked. Well, this is the best it's ever been for us. This moment right now, this band is going to make more money and going to be able to get more music out to people with zero hurdles. So I'd have to contest it. If you're telling me that we are a rock style band, then I'm going to have to call bullshit on all of that. I'm going to say it's completely false.
Have you guys seen over the last 10 years the culture of touring? How has that changed?
That's a tough question. I mean, there's a lot of obvious ways where technology and cell phones and all that have made it. We used to, when we first started, we would, like, I guess, print out MapQuest directions and we'd have a big binder.
Yeah. So you don't but get even lost
that's
as
not
often.
That old school. I mean, we could have been on maps, you know. Yeah. So we still had the internet.
But insofar as, you know, connecting with bands in other cities, has that gotten easier? Can you get, can you kind of say to a band, oh, you know, we really should not play with those guys? It's just not going to be a good match?
Yeah, and I think, too, we just did a tour in the UK with a band from Orange County, California called King.
Mm-hmm.
Really good band. And we did and on the same tour was a band from Athens, Greece, Planet of Zeus.
Whoa.
And we're all on a bus together, and Planet of Zeus, out of control, good band from Athens. And then I think you realize that the current touring situation, everyone's, I think there's a lot of, bands out there, and because there's so many bands and so many shows to see, I think everybody's, you see that even a band from Europe is trying to cut corners in the same way that you're trying to cut corners, and everyone really is in the same boat because the money is not the same as it was 10 years ago.
True.
That you see bands that used to, you still see plenty of bands on tour buses that absolutely should not be, or that have six crew guys for a three-piece band. You see a lot more bands, intelligent bands, starting to kind of rise to the top because they know how to tour smart. And I think that's what's kind of happened, is that you still have the same dummies that you've always had doing it, but then you kind of, the camaraderie between the bands that, oh, well, this place, you know, that if you talk to the venue, they'll give you 60% off the hotel room, or, you know, it kind of, you find the people that are way more like you way quicker, if that makes sense.
And so just then you get a better tour in general from that.
Yes, for sure. I mean, we have plans we've been working out to go to Greece and bring these guys over here. And, you know, I don't think that wouldn't have happened as easily 10 years ago.
Sure. Even with email. So then you guys are a fan of the digital space. You guys like pretty much everything that it does. Where do you see things kind of going from here? Because, again, you guys have seen a lot of music and you've seen a lot of changes. Where do you see kind of the creative process going from here? Do you think we're going to just kind of lose studios? And as they've always said for so many years, you know, the big labels will fall and all that, you know, the kind of the future of the industry.
Maybe the big labels will fall. I don't think we'll lose studios. I don't think you'll ever lose the, you know, boutique appeal of going to, you know, like Rick Rubin or whatever famous producer kind of guy. That probably won't ever go away, but a lot less bands will go to those guys, and a lot less smaller bands will have the opportunity to work with those guys. But then on the other side of it, you know, I think there'll be a lot more stuff, a lot more music.
Musically, if you were to describe your music to someone who hadn't heard it before.
That's a popular question, and there's been a lot of really different and good answers over the years.
Yeah, I mean, we have people... We've had Eric Oblander, the singer of Five Horse Johnson, tell us that we were power reggae.
Someone told me once we were Black Sabbath meets Black Uhuru.
You know, I think at the end of the day, we're a rock band
that's
exploring whatever the fuck we want to explore. And I think, I wish more bands would. I wish more bands would come to the table like Clutch did, and start exploring blues and funk and go-go. And, you know, how many times can you play a pentatonic riff? Thin Lizzy, go back to Thin Lizzy. Uh-huh. Listen to how all their records sound different, and their every song is different. And but it's never not Thin Lizzy.
Right.
It's always Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
But they're exploring Irish folk music, or they're exploring blues, or they're, you know.
You have to trust that you're the same band no matter what you're playing. It's still you guys. So you don't need to be confined by these abstract definitions of what it stylistically is or isn't. It's just the four of us playing the best thing we can play.
My thanks again to the guys from Lion Eyes for making time for me and for getting me out of the rain. Right before I went to do that interview, it just started pouring here in New York, and I showed up to the Knitting Factory just soaked, and they hooked me up with a t-shirt so that I didn't have to walk around in a wet t-shirt, because trust me, folks, it is nowhere near as attractive as it sounds. So anyway, if Lion Eyes are coming to your town, do your ears a favor. Check them out, lioneyesmusic.com and over on Twitter at lioneyesmusic. Now, before we call it quits for the day, I do, of course, have your weekly Ear Fuel listening assignment. For those of you who are new to the podcast, each week I assign an album for you to listen to in full without distraction, because I firmly believe that people have forgotten what it means to listen to music for the sake of listening to music. It's kind of been relegated to background noise when you're at work, you're driving, whatever. And this is a weekly attempt to remedy that. So this week, your assignment is Tori Amos's 1996 album, Boys for Pele. Tori remains one of my all-time favorite artists, and while most people will understandably point to her first two records, which are good, there's no question that this is my favorite of hers, as well as being one of my top 10 favorite albums of all time. Boys for Pele is slightly darker than her previous albums, if you can believe that, and it's in many ways more of a narrative to me. You can really sink into these songs, and they have this depth to them that really makes you want to listen to it over and over again. It's the sort of record that you can really get lost in, find shelter in, whatever it is you need to do. I think much of this change comes from the fact that this was her first time actually producing her own work, and I really feel like the overall product, it reflects a clearer representation of what she was kind of about musically at the time. You have these amazing, oddly upbeat hooks like Tallulah and In the Springtime of His Voodoo, and then you have the big single Caught a Light Sneeze that a lot of people know, but for me, it's the quieter moments like Hey Jupiter, Putting the Damage On, Way Down. Those are the songs for me that really make this record fly. There is not a bad second anywhere on this record. I love every single moment. And to be honest, this is one of those records that it's just magical to me. And if you don't experience it firsthand, you're not going to get it. Trust me on this. Boys for Pele is a life changer. So that's all for this time. As always, come follow me in my musical madness over at @GetEarFuel and @TheDailyGuru. And hey, if you dug the podcast, go out and tell a friend or five to check it out. That's your weekly Ear Fuel. Share and enjoy. We'll be right back.